Welcome again to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Environmental hazards are a major health concern for many of us in the United States. We'll discuss several of these environmental hazards today with my guest, Dr. David Carpenter. Dr. Carpenter is the director of the Institute for Health and Environmental and the Environment and professor of environmental health and sciences at the School of Public Health, the University of Albany. Also in the studio with me today is Garen Tarr, representing Alaska Community Action on Toxics. If you've got questions or comments, you can reach us three ways, two phone numbers. 550-8433 is our local number. 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@kska.org. Dr. Carpenter and Garen, welcome once again to Line One.
Thank you very much.
Nice to have you here. So let's start by talking about why you're in Alaska.
Well, I'm here with the Alaska Community Action on Toxics. We've just come back from St. Lawrence Island, where we met with the elders of the two villages on St. Lawrence Island, as well as three federal and state agencies, to discuss the issue of contaminants, persistent organic contaminants and metals in traditional foods. And then we have a training session here in Anchorage this week that I'm taking part in.
Is this a unique problem to St. Lawrence, or is it?
It's not unique to St. Lawrence at all. It's a problem throughout the Arctic, and it's a particular problem in Alaska because and other parts of the Arctic, because many of these chemical contaminants, although we haven't manufactured them for many years, they're very persistent. They're semi-volatile, so they go into the air in my backyard in New York, where my office is right by the contaminated Hudson River, and they migrate to the polar regions after they volatilize. And then in the cold climate of the Arctic, they come out of the vapor phase, they bioconcentrate, they get into the fat of animals and fish, and most Alaska native populations eat a lot of animal fat, especially marine mammal fat, and therefore they get exposed to high concentrations of these chemicals.
And so you mentioned this is true throughout the Arctic, and is Alaska specifically more of an issue for any particular reason, like what the subsistence foods might be, or is it true in Greenland and other parts of the Arctic?
Well, it's actually worse in Greenland, and this is all the function of the air currents.
Okay.
Greenland gets the air currents from the eastern United States. Alaska, and particularly western Alaska, tends to get the air currents from Russia, from China, to a lesser degree from Japan. So the air currents coming to this part of Alaska are not quite from as developed regions as those in Greenland. But the problem is the same. It's the magnitude is not quite as bad here. But these are dangerous chemicals, and they increase the risk of a variety of human diseases. And therefore, it's very important to know what the levels of the contaminants are, what the diseases of concern are, and to try to provide some advice to these people on how they can reduce their exposure.
Garen, the Alaska Community on Toxics is involved in some of this community-based research. Is that one of the things they're really pushing?
It is, yes, Dr. Woodard. Thanks for having us today. ACAT has been doing great work like this in Alaska for about 12 years now, and one of the things that makes the organization unique is the community-based research. And ACAT really tries to work at the request of a community, and so what was happening in the case of St. Lawrence Island is elders there were noticing changes in their subsistence foods, and so actually were looking for someone to help them figure out what was going on. So community-based research, working with communities, really being asked to be a part of it is an important part of the work that ACAT's doing.
Well, tell us a little bit more about what you know so far with St. Lawrence in particular.
Well, we began by measuring blood concentrations of PCBs and pesticides in the residents of St. Lawrence Island. There was concern on the island, there still is concern, about two former military bases there. In the Cold War, two bases were established, one right at the village of Gambell, which is the closest point of the U.S. to Russia. The other, at the other end of the island, which was an Air Force base at Northeast Cape. Now, at the present time, there is no village at Northeast Cape, but the contamination there was very considerable. When the military left those bases, they basically dug a hole and buried everything at Gamble because it was a village. The Northeast Cape, they didn't even dig the hole. They just left lots of barrels and buildings and so forth. But the Yupiks on St. Lawrence Island go to that area for their spring hunts. And the people tended to blame the military as the sole source of their exposure. What we found is that the Yupiks have much higher levels of PCBs and pesticides, but particularly PCBs, in their blood than are found in the lower 48 on average, something like six times higher. And we initially compared people that had hunting camps at the Northeast Cape to the rest of the people. We found, yes, they had somewhat higher levels, but not very much higher. So yes, the military bases are important, but the major factor is this global transport by air of these semi-volatile compounds that come from the industrialized regions of the world. It's called the grasshopper effect, because like a grasshopper jumping, these contaminants volatilize when the weather is hot. When it's cold, they precipitate, then they volatilize again, and they get here in the cold climate of the Arctic and they stay. But they get absorbed by animals and fish. They're in their fat. And so the latest study that we've done is to analyze the levels of PCBs and pesticides in a great variety of traditional foods. What we've found is all of the animal fats, whether it be whale, seal, or walrus, the marine mammals, particularly the polar bear, all of which are eaten by these communities. The fats have very high levels of PCBs and pesticides. The meats do not. And the level in the fats, if one applies the recommendations for fish consumption developed by EPA, which tells you if the fish has this level of PCBs, you could eat this number of meals every month without increasing your risk of cancer. The fats in general trigger a recommendation of don't ever eat them. But these are part of everyday diets of many of the people in Native Alaska. And so we have a real quandary here. It's certainly not appropriate to tell anybody what to eat or what not to eat. But I do believe that it's important to inform communities that if they are concerned about diseases like cancer and many other diseases that we know elevate the risk of developing disease, when you're exposed to them, eat more of the meat, eat less of the fat.
So there's a certain irony here. I often like to talk about coincidence and causality. And the individuals in St. Lawrence were worried, but they were worried about the wrong thing. But they were right to be worried.
They were right to be worried. And it isn't entirely the wrong thing, because the military bases did increase the levels somewhat.
Okay.
But that's not the primary concern. Okay. And unfortunately, the fact that that's not the primary concern has implications for all of the rest of Arctic Alaska, because these contaminants are coming in from everywhere. And there's not, at the present time, much one can do about it, short of having other places get rid of these contaminants, remediate the contaminant sites, prevent these things from going into the air. But at the same time, there is something an individual can do by adjusting their diet to reduce their exposure to the highest levels of these chemicals.
I think it's extremely important to recognize that the natives are at risk. But I'm jealous, I'm aware of my own risk, and I live in a northern climate. Lots of people live near the Arctic Circle, and I'm thinking of Scandinavia, and we might be eating caribou are, but particularly oily fish, salmon. Do we know that there might be a risk for non-traditional eating habits in Arctic climates that parallel this risk?
Well, let me answer that question first, but then also answer one you didn't quite ask, which
was close
is, are these contaminants in other foods?
Right. Okay.
I think the answer is that anybody that eats animal fats is at risk. Now, I was one of the authors of a study a few years ago on the contaminants in farmed versus wild salmon, something very near and dear to Alaska.
Right.
And we found that farmed salmon from around the world, Europe, Eastern Canada, Western Canada, Chile, farmed salmon have 10 times as much of these contaminants
right.
as do the five species of wild salmon that you find here in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
But all salmon have some. Mm-hmm. And the biggest salmon, the Chinook, the kings, they have the highest amount, and they sometimes almost approach the farm salmon. Now, the farm salmon get their contaminants because of the fish oil that they're fed. The bigger salmon, the longer-lived ones, they get their contaminants just from the contamination of the oceans.
Now, to go back, by air again, by air currents? Or?
Air currents, but also by the contaminants washing out of rivers and streams.
Okay.
I live by the Hudson River, highly contaminated. Okay. It dumps into the Atlantic Ocean. Now, we found that farm salmon in Northern Europe were more contaminated than those in North America, which in turn were more contaminated than those in Chile. And that reflects the fact that they catch these small fish, grind them up, feed them to the salmon. And Northern Europe has a longer industrial history than does North America. And North America has more than South America. But I was also on a panel of the Institute of Medicine a few years ago that looked at dioxin-like chemicals in the food supply. And the fact is that you can't drink whole milk, you can't eat an egg, you can't have a hamburger, a pork chop, or any other animal fat in our country today without getting some of these chemicals.
That include breast milk?
That certainly includes breast milk.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is we feed waste animal fats, including fish meal and fish oil, to our farmed animals. And these are animals that are not normally carnivorous, but they grow faster and it's cheaper if you feed them waste fat. So because of mad cow disease, now we don't feed the cow fat to the cows. We feed it to the pigs and the chickens. We feed the pig and the chicken fat to the cows, and they grow faster. But we're recycling these chemicals that we stopped making 40 years ago back into the animals that we eat. So we're all exposed to the same thing. But it's a basic principle of toxicology that the risk is related to the concentration. And so none of us can avoid some exposure to these things, but it's to our advantage to reduce our exposure as much as possible.
Yeah. So just to, again, to try to put some perspective on this, we know that these persistent organic pollutants are at a higher level than they've ever been. We're understanding where they're coming from and how they get where they're going. So the next issue would be, what do we know about disease? What do we know that they're associated with, or if we're really good, cause that we need to be aware of?
All right, let me take the first point first.
Okay.
Because the levels on average are going down for some of these chemicals we stopped making a long time ago.
Okay.
The problem is they're not going down in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
They're moving from the lower 48 and from other industrialized countries, and they're concentrating in the Arctic. So the levels in Alaska are going up. Now, in terms of the diseases, there are a number of different chemicals, and they don't all do exactly the same thing. But let me talk about PCBs, because these are the ones that are the highest concentration here and almost everywhere else. PCBs cause cancer. They're not a mutagenic carcinogen, so they increase the risk of all kinds of cancer. They suppress the immune system. Now, that's related to cancer because our immune system is one of our first defenses against cancer. But our immune system also is a defense against infection. So when you get a bad cold, it won't go away. Most people don't think of environmental exposures as being responsible. It may be a virus or a bacterium that's ultimately responsible, but our immune system is suppressed and doesn't have the ability to deal with it. A major concern is these chemicals reduce IQ and memory. Best documented in children, and this is why the concentration in breast milk is so significant. This appears to be an irreversible reduction in IQ, very much like lead and methylmercury and even environmental cigarette smoke all reduce IQ, probably irreversibly. The recent things that I and a number of other people have been looking at are the chronic diseases that adults find: hypertension, heart disease, diabetes. And these diseases have not previously been ascribed to environmental causes beyond smoking. Everybody knows smoking has been important. But for example, just last week, we published a study on hypertension, and we found that the level of PCBs in people's bloods was a bigger predictor of whether or not they developed hypertension than any other factor except age and obesity. And furthermore, we found that even people that had blood pressures within what would be called a normal range, the higher their PCB level, the higher their blood pressure. For diabetes, it appears it's not so much the PCBs as it is the pesticides, but PCBs and pesticides go together. So the metabolite of DDT, which was used widely here in Alaska as well as everywhere else, hexachlorobenzene, a pesticide that was widely used, these factors increase the risk of diabetes enormously. And what's really interesting in studies that were done by a group both in Korea and the University of Minnesota, they found that obese people that did not have high levels of these contaminants did not appear to be at elevated risk of diabetes. Now, every physician will tell you the major risk factor for diabetes is obesity and lack of exercise. Well, why are people obese? They're obese usually because they eat too many animal fats. That's the source of the contaminants. So I think even that obesity-diabetes relationship is being revisited. Mm-hmm. And what we're asking now is how much are the environmental contaminants contributing? So a whole variety of diseases.
Let me remind our listeners real quickly. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. My guest today is Dr. David Carpenter. He's director of the Institute for Health and Environment at the University of Albany. Sitting in also is Garen Tarr of the Alaska Community Actions and on Toxics, our Alaska Community Actions on Toxics. So if you've got questions or comments about anything you hear today, please don't hesitate to give us a call. You can reach us locally at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@kska.org. I'm sitting here thinking that, you know, so often I get information sent to me wanting me to present somebody who has got a new theory about, you know, irradiated foods causing problems, And here you're a great scientist, a good scientist, a good thinker, and I don't want, I'm trying to put some perspective on this issue. Clearly, association and cause is difficult, and we are beginning to recognize some associations is what you're saying here, and then we're trying to understand if those associations mean cause and effect. Do we have really good evidence about some of the chronic diseases, or are we just making these associations right now?
At the present time, we're making associations.
Okay.
And you're absolutely right.
Then that leads to the more specific studies looking at causation often.
That's right. Yeah. And it's very difficult to get to causation.
Right.
Causation means 100% certainty.
Right.
To get to causation, you must document a mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know a mechanism for most of these things. Now, I didn't talk much about heart disease, but we do know one of the mechanisms for heart disease, and that is that exposure to PCBs causes the liver to make cholesterol and triglycerides. The biggest risk factor for heart attack is your serum lipids.
Mm-hmm.
So we know a mechanism there, mm-hmm. and that doesn't prove causation, but it's part on the way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we know another thing about these chemicals is they cause induction of huge numbers of genes, hundreds of genes, and genes that do a whole variety of other things. That likely is going to be our clue to finding the mechanism, but we're not there yet. So what we're finding are very strong associations, but associations do not mean causation, and there clearly needs to be more research.
We have stimulated a couple of phone calls, and I want to get to them. But you mentioned the genetics, and to me, the genetics has become so much more complex as we begin to understand that it's not just one gene, one protein anymore. And so all of these
kinds of studies, the things we've done in the past, we have to kind of almost relook at, and it gets extremely complex to see why certain genes may be turned on at certain times by lots of things in the environment.
Exactly right. And other genes are turned off.
So that's why we get into this issue of potentially exposures and the chronic diseases, diabetes, atherosclerosis, obesity.
Absolutely.
Arthritis. Okay. All right. Let's see if we can get our first caller on the air. Phil, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Oh, hi. I've got a couple things. One is I think the vapor pressure of PCBs is about 0.01 millimeters of mercury, maybe lower. And so I'm wondering how it volatilizes and makes it up to the Arctic. And the second thing is I used to work in environmental contracting for over 20 years, and they would monitor our blood level for PCBs, but wouldn't it be more appropriate to measure the level of PCBs in our fat? And I'll go ahead and take my your responses off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, thanks, Phil. The last question first. Yes, it's easier to measure PCBs in fat, but that's, in fact, what we do when we measure blood. You know, taking a fat biopsy usually means two big, very fat needles in your butt, and that's not much fun. Our blood does have fat, and usually it's about 1/200th of the volume of the serum. And so the PCB analysis that we do in my lab and most other labs uses blood samples because it's much easier. Now, with regard to the vapor pressure, I agree with you. The vapor pressure of PCBs is not very high, but it's not a single constant because PCBs are still a mixture of compounds, and those PCBs with lower chlorines are more volatile. However, you can measure the PCBs in the air. That's how they get to the Arctic for the most part. We are now finding that we can measure the PCB pattern in blood that matches the PCB pattern in air in certain circumstances, such as schools that are highly contaminated with PCBs in window caulking. They go into the air, the people breathe them in, and you get the pattern of the vapor phase PCBs rather than the original pattern. So it doesn't take high volatility to cause these compounds to migrate, and especially to migrate here to the Arctic.
Okay. Let's take another caller. Patty, you're on line one.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was interested because I spent time in Savunga in the 90s, and I was struck by the number of facial disfigurements and cancer stories that I heard from the community members, and they were telling me about the cancer study, which I think was done by the University of New York, and I heard you speaking about causality and associations and things, and just anecdotally, it seemed like there was causality to be seen all through the community.
Well, this is the reason that we were invited to work with ACAT on doing a health study in Savunga and Gamble. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to do a cancer study in a small population. And there are only about 800 people in each of the two villages on St. Lawrence Island. So you get these anecdotal reports. It was a woman, Annie Aloy, who was suffering from breast cancer that triggered the original request to ACAT, which led to the people on St. Lawrence Island coming to me to have us do these studies. There's a fair bit of information here in Alaska from the cancer registries you have statewide, but it's very, very difficult to study cancer in a small population because even when it's elevated, it's not a large number of people. There is the widespread perception that there's high rates of cancer on the island, but our studies to date have not been able to focus on analysis of that that amount.
Okay, thank you.
And just to throw some reason into this, even if there was a documented high rate of cancer on the island, that doesn't necessarily mean it's due to these organic pollutants that are there, even if they are there in a high amount.
Well, yes and no. I think the evidence that PCBs are carcinogenic is pretty much overwhelming.
Okay.
Now, there are a lot of other things that cause cancer.
Right.
There's a lot of smoking on the island. Smoking is really clearly the number one public health hazard, and it's a major issue in Alaska Native communities. That's something individuals can do something about, where it's very difficult to do much about the PCBs. So I'm not saying that all of the cancer is related to the PCBs. There is a perception in the community that
it is.
The PCBs and the military bases are what caused the cancer.
Yeah, my point is just in this program to constantly make people be aware and think. And let me be a little bit more specific. I've just been listening to a podcast from Stanford on evolution of infectious diseases, and heard a guy talking about when you look at breast cancer tissues, a very high percentage of them you find human papillomavirus in a number of them compared to. In the cancer cells in the breast compared to normal tissue that's not there, as well as Epstein-Barr virus. So there are potential other mechanisms whereby these things could group together in a population, I guess.
Oh, you're absolutely right.
Playing the devil's advocate here. We got to be careful about jumping to conclusions.
Right. And that's why it's impossible to study cancer in a small population.
Okay.
That's why we do these cancer studies. And again, you're always looking for associations, and proving causation is extraordinarily difficult. Yep. Dioxin is rated by the World Health Organization as a proven human carcinogen, mainly on the basis of occupational studies. PCBs and most of these pesticides are rated as probable human carcinogens. Because in people, you're never exposed to only one of those compounds. You're exposed to everything migrating together. They're all in your fat. So when you get cancer, you can't say it was the DDT rather than the PCBs rather than the hexachlorobenzene. We're all exposed to mixtures of chemicals, many of which are carcinogens, but others are not. Then there's our own genetic predisposition, which is important. Now, there was an interesting study out of Scandinavia on identical twins about 10 years ago, published in the New England Journal of Medicine. It asked the question, how much cancer is due to genetics and how much is due to environment? And the idea was, if cancer is caused by genetics, then identical twins should all get the same cancer. The conclusion of that study was 85% of cancer is caused by environmental exposures and not by genetics, which it doesn't deny the existence of genetic susceptibility factors,
right?
But it does say that cancer is not just genetic.
Yeah, and it gets to the current paradigm for a lot of our chronic diseases, where it takes a genetic predisposition, but it takes an environmental hit.
That's right. The initiating event is environmental.
Environment acting on the genetics is where we think asthma and arthritis and cancers. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay. We're going to have to take a very short break. I want to make sure everybody knows you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. In Anchorage, our phone number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1, and it's spelled out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, also at kska.org. After this break, we'll continue to take your calls and emails and talk with Professor of Environmental Health Sciences, Dr. David Carpenter, on Line 1, Your Health Connection.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen to Line 1, Your Health Connection again, tune in tonight at 8. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking telephone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, Line 1 will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're discussing environmental health hazards with Dr. David Carpenter. He's Professor of Environmental Health Sciences at the School of Public Health at the University of Albany. Email your questions and comments to line1@kska.org and give us a call, 550-8433, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752.
please remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 locally, you're listening to a recorded rebroadcast. We won't be here. So if you've got your questions on your mind, you might as well give us a call or send us an email right now. Here is an email I got. Can one of these chemicals, I suspect they're referring to the persistent organic pollutants, be avoided by buying organic dairy products and grass-fed beef?
Well, the answer is that's a good idea, and it would reduce your exposure. But the question is, what does organic mean? And usually what organic means is nobody adds any chemical to the feed or no pesticide is used, that sort of thing. But it never is going to result in a total absence of these compounds, because we've already talked a little bit about how children get exposed. They get exposed before birth from the mother's body, and they get exposed from breast milk. That's true for cows and pigs and chickens as well. So there is a residue of these contaminants that can be found even in animals that are raised without additional chemicals. Grass-fed animals are better than commercially fed animals, because there isn't going to be any of this added animal fat that's going to contain contaminants.
We experienced a big oil spill several years ago in the Gulf, and there's now the Gulf of Mexico oil spill, and I'm sitting here listening to you talk about the air currents and these persistent organic pollutants. But what do we know about human risk of any sort from these oil spills? Is it too early to know much, or what can we talk about?
Well, we know, again, anecdotal information, because there hasn't really been a lot of scientific study. But a lot of the emergency responders are getting very sick. Now, there are a variety of factors. The ones at greatest risk are clearly those that have been operating closest to the spill, that are being exposed to vapors released from the crude oil. Crude oil contains a lot of volatile organics that they go into the air, they evaporate. So by the time the tar balls hit the beaches on Florida, there aren't going to be many of these volatile chemicals left. But if you're trying to clean up oil right near the spill, you're going to be breathing in a lot of these chemicals. And there are numerous reports now of severe acute respiratory disease in these emergency responders. Now, what the long-term effects of those exposures will be is still unclear. We know things like breathing in benzene causes a risk of cancer. A number of these compounds are carcinogenic. Again, as with other carcinogens, it's how much you're exposed to over what period of time. So I think it's too early to say exactly what's going to be the outcome, but I'm concerned about both acute and long-term respiratory disease and the possibility of cancer in people that are the emergency responders. I think the people that are swimming at the beaches that have tar balls are much less at risk, because while that may be unpleasant and nasty, it doesn't result in the acute health hazard that the exposure to the crude oil does.
Was there enough known about this evaporative issue and air currents and the movement of persistent organic pollutants at the time of the Alaska Valdez that there was some kind of surveillance undertaken to look and see where those things went and who was at possible risk?
I don't think there was, although I shouldn't pass myself as an expert on Valdez. But there is one important difference between those volatile compounds and the persistent organic compounds. Those compounds are much more volatile, but they're also much more easily broken down by sunlight and by the environment. Okay. So they don't travel nearly as far. They're not going to come up to Alaska, because they'll be destroyed on the way. And that's a very important difference.
Then remind me again, just real quickly, I'll take a couple of phone calls. Where do these persistent organic pollutants come from specifically? We may have talked about it and I didn't hear it.
Well, PCBs were very useful for a variety of purposes. They are an oil. They were used as insulators for electrical capacitors. Mm-hmm. They were used as hydraulic fluids. They were used where we would use mineral oil today in paints, as solvents for window caulking. They were in ceiling tiles, in carbonless paper. They had many, many useful uses. And when we discovered that they were persistent and they were appearing in the Arctic, that's when we banned them in 1977. So at that time, we had hot spots of contamination around the plants that used them. What's happened since then is the levels in those hot spots have gone down as they've gone into the air and migrated up here. Mm-hmm. And so they spread around the world to a much greater degree. And that's true for the pesticides as well. We use pesticides everywhere. Mosquito control, killing pests on plants. And we didn't realize these things don't go away. And now we're still exposed to them. And then we have some new persistent compounds. We have brominated flame retardants that are in our upholstery, our computers, our rugs. And these compounds are structurally similar to PCBs, but we're still manufacturing and using them. And the levels of those are rising rapidly in the U.S. population. They're beginning to appear here in the Arctic. So it's as though we never learned the lesson of these persistent compounds.
Okay. All right. I've got a couple of callers. Sean, you're on line one.
Yeah. I was just asking a couple questions about, one, the cumulative properties of PCBs in the body, if they can get flushed out, and also about how they travel through the food chain, if they do. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Sean. Good questions. The half-life of PCBs in the body, in the human body, are of the order of 5 to 10 years. That means if you ate a contaminated meal last night, you're going to have half of those PCBs in your body at least 5 years from now, maybe more like 10 years. And this is the real problem. For all of us, on average, we take in these compounds more rapidly than our body can get rid of them. And so that really is a problem. Now, I've already forgotten the second.
How do you remove them?
How do you remove them? The problem is there is no good way of doing so. The only mechanism that has been reported is eating a lot of Pringles potato chips made of Olestra, that non-absorbable fat. Now, of course, if you do that, and it's been done, it's probably what they did with Yushchenko, the prime minister of the Ukraine that was poisoned with dioxin. You have violent diarrhea. You lose all of your absorption of the fat-soluble vitamins, so it's not a very realistic way. And the reality is that once these are in our body, we don't have any good means of getting them out.
I'm always hesitant, but there's always somebody out there telling you they've got a way, and I'm going to bring up the word chelation. should we make it clear if it's true that the chelation is not going to get rid of these things?
Chelation doesn't grab PCBs. There's no way. Chelation is used for metals, but it's not used for organic compounds.
All right, maybe I was stretching it, but I can envision somebody trying to make a lot of money on that. Chancey, you're on line one.
Thank you. I wanted to thank David Carpenter for coming to Alaska, and you, Dr. Thad, for presenting such interesting and informative shows. I had two questions. One, environmental medicine, is that a new area of medicine like dermatology or allergy or immunology? That's my first question.
Well, it really is a new discipline in medicine, because I think in the past the medical community hasn't really paid much attention to environmental exposures. We've had occupational medicine for a long time, and environmental exposures are a big part of occupational medicine. But environmental medicine is becoming a new specialty as we get more information about environmental causes of disease.
My second question, you kind of segued into it, is firefighters and cancer. And other, you were talking about emergency responders to oil spills. What about emergency responders like 9/11 or just the fires in general and cancer?
Well, a great concern. Firefighters and certainly emergency responders in 9/11, and I've had some personal involvement there. These people have extraordinary exposures. They're exposed to mixtures of chemicals, and there have, to my mind, not been adequate studies of the health of firefighters and emergency responders. We know from 9/11 that many of the emergency responders have chronic respiratory disease from inhaling this very alkaline, this high pH dust, and they're going to suffer the rest of their lives with chronic respiratory disease as a result of that exposure. We know that asthma rates have increased in children living in lower Manhattan. So these are important considerations, and it's a hazardous profession to be an emergency responder in some of these situations.
Thank you.
All right, Chancey, thanks for your call.
You bet.
Let's switch gears. I know you're an expert in electromagnetic field risks. So let's talk about power lines, cell phones, appliances, the Earth's magnetic field, all of those things.
All of those things. Now, let me say right up front, relative to the danger of POPs, this is minor.
Okay, good. I like to put things in perspective.
But I think the risk is real.
Okay.
Let me give you a little background on my involvement. I first came to New York in 1980 as the director of the laboratories for the Department of Health. And 2 weeks before I got to New York, there had been a settlement over a suit between two agencies around the health risks or possible health risks from high-voltage power lines. I was put in charge of administering a research program. At that time, there had been one publication arguing that children that lived near power lines that had high magnetic fields were more at risk to develop leukemia. We supported a study also in Denver, Colorado, that confirmed that relationship. Since that time, there have been a number of studies, almost all of them uniformly confirm the conclusion that children that live in homes with elevated magnetic field are somewhere between 1.5 and 4-fold greater risk of developing leukemia than children that don't live in those environments. Now, there's been a lot of skepticism by government agencies, and that skepticism has been based on two factors. One, nobody has ever really demonstrated cancer in rats and mice exposed to power line fields. And number two, we don't really know a mechanism whereby these low energy electromagnetic fields can cause cancer. In my judgment, neither is an appropriate yardstick. Now, for most carcinogens, we use rats and mice. We give them a chemical, they develop cancer. If the rat gets cancer, we think maybe it's dangerous for humans. Here we have consistent, repeated evidence that children exposed to high magnetic fields develop cancer. And I should say there's also consistent evidence for adults and leukemia if they work in occupations where they're exposed to elevated magnetic fields. So the fact that we have evidence in people and not in animals, I don't think is an excuse. We've talked a little bit about mechanisms of cancer. PCBs and dioxins are not mutagenic carcinogens. They don't damage DNA. Neither do low-frequency electromagnetic fields. We don't know the mechanism of most kinds of cancer. So that's not an excuse. So while leukemia in children, it gets about one in every 10,000 children per year. So it's not a very common disease, but it's a real one. Now let's talk about cell phones. Cell phones, you use a higher frequency electromagnetic field. Now we know at the high end of the electromagnetic spectrum, we have X-rays and gamma rays and cosmic rays. These are ionizing, they cause direct DNA damage. They cause cancer. Sunlight has somewhat lower energy. And then we have these radio frequency fields that are part of our communication system, radio, television, cell phones. There still is a lot of debate here. The evidence coming out of Scandinavia particularly is very consistent and, in my judgment, very concerning. People that talk on cell phones frequently for 10 years or more are at elevated risk of developing brain cancer, but only on the side of the head where they use the cell phone, and only after 10 years or more of use. So the other side of the head is really the control there. What is even of greater concern, single study, so by no means proven. But another study from Sweden showing that if a teenager begins to use a cell phone before the age of 20, they are at 5 times greater risk than if an adult starts to use a cell phone. Now, cell phones haven't been around that long, particularly in the U.S. I was at St. Lawrence Island a year ago. In the intervening year, cell phone coverage came to St. Lawrence Island. And our kids, even preteens, are on the cell phone constantly. Fortunately, a lot of them are texting, which gets the phone away from the head. But I see this as something that is likely to increase as time goes on, as we get more and more evidence. There needs to be much more study of this. Brain cancer and leukemia, the cancers most tied to electromagnetic fields. Again, fortunately, they're not very common. But I would predict that we're going to see a rise in the rates of brain cancer. We already are seeing a rise in rates. Not enormous rise, but we don't know the mechanisms. And so I think this is an emerging environmental health issue that should be followed. There are some simple things one can do that reduces your exposure. First of all, if you actually read the fine print, most cell phone instructions say, don't hold it right to your head, hold it about an inch away. Nobody reads that and nobody does it. Use a wired earpiece. Keep the cell phone on the table. One thing I would predict is many men, businessmen, wear their cell phone on their belt. They may use a Bluetooth or a wired earpiece. It reduces their exposure to the brain, but it doesn't reduce the exposure to the pelvis. Mm-hmm. And if electromagnetic fields cause cancer, we'll probably see the rise in GI and prostate cancer in the future.
What's the relative amount of radiation of force or field, right term, Gauss, that's of cell phones relative to microwaves or red electric can openers? I mean, there's other sources of these kinds of radiation.
Well, electromagnetic fields vary in terms of frequency.
Mm-hmm.
So the X-rays have high frequency. The electric fields from electricity have low frequency.
Okay.
In the U.S., that's 60 cycles per second. So okay. A can opener is 60 cycles per second.
Okay.
AM radio is quite a bit higher than that. FM is higher yet. Cell phones are higher yet. And so the energy conveyed in these various forms of radiation, many people assume that is related to their harm. But it's a very complicated relationship. And I don't think we understand really what that means. So what I pay attention to is what evidence we have from human exposures and the diseases they get.
Okay. Got an email somewhat related to this issue of radiation. It says, would you ask if or how much risk there is in being radiated after a breast lumpectomy? So I think the unhidden or the hidden question is there increased risk to subsequent cancers after radiation for a lumpectomy?
Now we're talking about the ionizing part of the electromagnetic spectrum, or in some cases even particulate ionizing radiation. I think the answer clearly is that any ionizing radiation exposure increases your risk of cancer. Now, that doesn't mean it's not valuable or even essential in treating cancers that have developed, because radiation can both cause cancer and kill cancer cells. And that's why after a lumpectomy, if that lump is found to be cancerous, routinely many physicians will recommend either chemotherapy or radiation therapy as a means of killing any cancer cells that are not found there. But we know particularly from years of study of childhood cancer, children that have had leukemia that have been radiated and given total body radiation with transplant of new bone marrow, they often go on to develop other cancers later on in life. So radiation is not to be treated lightly. It's very useful when properly done, but it does have a certain risk as well.
So there's this constant risk-benefit ratio. The radiation may save your life, but it may increase your risk to subsequent cancer.
Absolutely right. And let me go back to our earlier discussion, because that's a point I didn't make that I should have. The PCBs and the pesticides are all in the fat of the fish and the marine mammals. What else is in the fat are these healthy omega-3 fatty acids. Now, unfortunately, the omega-3 fatty acids don't reduce the risk of cancer, but they are reported to reduce the risk of dying after a heart attack. There's some evidence they reduce the risk of hypertension and diabetes. They are essential for the brain, and there are many reports that they help increase IQ. So risk-benefit is something you found everywhere, and one really must be careful not to focus only on the hazards of a particular foodstuff or a particular medical treatment, but to have some understanding of both the risks and the benefits.
And what's the risk of doing the treatment, for example, and what's the risk of not doing the treatment?
Exactly right.
Which gets difficult. People would like to have a risk-free option. Doesn't exist.
They don't exist.
Little off the subject, but one we've talked about before. I'd like your opinion, if you think you can render it, on irradiated foods. It's another issue that's generating a lot of information.
I worked for 7 years for the Defense Nuclear Agency, which is the part of the Department of Defense that counts the nuclear weapons at night, puts them to sleep. I think the public fear of irradiated food is totally misplaced. What irradiation does, now this is ionizing radiation. Most of those particles of radiation hit water molecules. They create what we call free radicals. They last for fractions of a microsecond, and they kill cells. They kill bacteria. They leave no residual radiation. Now, when you put your potato in the microwave, you're doing the same thing. You're causing movement of the water molecules, and you are changing the structure of the proteins and the carbohydrates in the potato. There is no residual radiation from there, nor is there any residual radiation if your steak is irradiated to kill infectious organisms. So I'm an advocate of irradiated food. We have a lot of human disease that comes from contaminated food, food contaminated with bacteria, with viruses, with parasites. And irradiation is one good, relatively inexpensive, and relatively non-toxic way of getting rid of these infectious organisms.
So we can get messed up on this because of perception versus reality. The perception is that all irradiation is bad, but once you really understand what's going on, there's not much risk.
And when you radiate yourself, that's bad. When you radiate your food before you're anywhere near it,
that's good.
It's good.
That's good. And then, okay, all right, enough said. One other issue that's somewhat pertinent here in town, we have a very large indoor facility with a large synthetic turf surface, and there's been some concerns about synthetic turf surfaces and some hazards. You want to discuss that?
Yes. This is an issue that's getting a lot of attention everywhere. What synthetic turf is little strips of green plastic that are supposed to look like grass embedded in a mat that's of ground-up tires. And actually, I was on the New England Patriots ball field when my son was playing lacrosse a couple of years ago, the first time I really had an opportunity to examine synthetic turf. The problem is that to make plastic anything, you use a lot of these organic solvents. And they just don't stay put. They can evaporate. Also, when you grind up tires, tires used to be made of rubber. There's still a little rubber there, but there's a lot of plastic and there's a lot of metal. And so one of the big concerns is the amount of lead, the amount of arsenic, the amount of other metals in the synthetic turf. Now, I actually haven't come in in contact with the issue of indoor synthetic turf, I suspect that's less dangerous than outdoor. The big problem are the volatile vapors that come off, same thing that we talked about, the oil well in the Gulf, and the possibility that you would get some of these metals in your mouth and swallow them. They're dangerous. So is it better than grass? It's easier to maintain, but it has some associated health hazards.
And you mentioned before that the risk of the outdoor turfs may be greater in warmer areas because the heat increases the evaporative loss.
The heat increases the evaporative loss. There's a big problem that sometimes these surfaces get very, very hot and children will burn their body when they touch the turf. So it's not a magic cure-all. And for an indoor environment, probably is not such a bad thing.
Okay. We've got about 2 minutes, and I got one probably last email. A gentleman would like to know where he can get a Gauss meter to measure the EMF in and out of his home. Is it a good idea? Why don't I ask you that?
Well, I think it is a good idea. Let me just tell you that when my son, who's now 24, was about two, I got a Gauss meter and found that the side of his bedroom that the bed was against had higher fields than the other side. Just moved the bed across the room and reduced his exposure. Excuse me. Exactly where to get one, there are many electronic supply meters, supply companies that will offer these meters for sale. I don't know any offhand, but the meters for the electric fields, the magnetic fields from electricity, are different from those for the radio frequency fields. So a Gauss meter is the right term for a meter that would measure magnetic fields from power lines and appliances.
Would something as simple as a Radio Shack have something like that?
Probably not, but they would probably know where to get it.
Okay. Our last minute. Garen, I've not paid attention to you.
Either
one of you guys want to make some final comments?
No, we're happy to have Dr. Carpenter here with us for the Institute and also tomorrow doing a presentation for legislators and staff and talking about some of the public policy opportunities related to these issues and how we can prevent exposure. So a lot of the conversation today talked about prevention, and that's one of the things that we really want to work on. So thank you again, and it was a great show. Thanks, Dr. Carpenter.
Okay. It's my pleasure.
Is there a particular good website where people might go for good information? Does it ring any bells? I know I'm hitting you out of the blue with that question.
Well, my institute has a website. Unfortunately, the website is always the last thing to get updated. If you go to www.albany.edu/IHE.
We have that link on our website, actually. So
fantastic.
If you just go to KSKA.org, line one, you'll have that link to and a couple more, okay? Thanks very much for taking the time to be with us, Dr. Carpenter.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having
wonderful.
Me.
Wonderful. Next week, you got it. We're going to be back. I'm going to talk for the third time with a good friend, consumer advocate and prominent health fraud and quackery expert, Dr. Stephen Barrett. P.T. Barnum was not referring to Dr. Barrett when he said there's a sucker born every minute. Pat Yak is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. Josh Edge manned the phones. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.